Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. Hi there, how are you? Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, episode number 140, toward the end of December, and I have a pretty good show lined up for you today. I think that we're going to have some fun here. We have a gentleman who has been here before, and it's pretty much one of the best times to have him because this week we saw the entire world watching what was going to happen with our next Federal Reserve chief and the grilling he took from Congress and senators. And we have some clips with that. And the gentleman who wrote the book all about the Fed, the origination, the beginnings of it, Ed Griffin's going to be here. He wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island. If you remember that, we talked to him some time ago, and that was the book that really went over, you know, the beginnings of the Fed and how it started, about almost a century ago, and where we have become and what has become of it today. So I thought we'd talk about that with him, talk about a few stock ideas, some things that are going on this week that we saw in the markets, both on an economic basis and on a stock basis. Some interesting questions that have been brought to bear, I think, that we have to look at, and maybe we can find some things to talk about that maybe will make us a couple of profits, of course, in a disciplined investor manner. Before we did that, I thought it would be kind of cool. We're past Thanksgiving a little bit. We're before the holidays, and I really wanted to spend just a moment thanking you for spending time and being here with me each and every week. I think it's great. It gives me an opportunity to express some of the frustrations that I have. I know that I see the emails that come in from you, the Twitter's responses, and the various Facebook commentaries that are, you know, also nice, but also so frustrated with what's going on with our country often, and or more primarily in our financial system. And, you know, this is the time that we get to spend time together. And I want to say for the 2 years that we've been doing this, I am just so thrilled at the audience and the thousands and tens of thousands, really, that are listening to us on a weekly basis. And it's been really, really great for me. So I want to say thank you. And I know that our friendship, and it is a bit of a friendship, sometimes seems, well, kind of one-sided. I do all the talking and you have to do all the listening. So I'm sorry about that, but that's kind of the way that it is right now. We're thinking about actually doing a two-way thing. I don't know. If you're interested in that, write me. You know, write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Because we're thinking about doing a little bit of a talk show where we have a call-in, we can answer questions and have a discussion. A couple of other people will join me. If that seems like a good idea, let me know. I don't know. We'll think about that for the new year. But the new year is coming. It's upon us soon. And we have about, 10 more days or so from the time we're talking about this that it will be the end of the year, and we're going to start a brand new year. The slate is clean, and there we go again. What's going to happen next? So, again, I just want to say thank you so much for being here, for telling everybody about us and the things that we do here, for your support. And if I could send you a card, each and every one of you, I would really just do so, and I'd handwrite it and say thank you so much. I wish you a wonderful and a prosperous and a joyous year. I'll probably say that in the next few weeks again, so I just want to make sure that you know it and that I really do mean it from the bottom of my heart, and thanks again. We'll also talk about the podcast awards. I was listening to those. We didn't win anything, but we did come in and was nominated for the People's Choice Award, so thank you so much. Also nominated for the Top Business Award for the Disciplined Investor, also the Winning Investor, and DH Unplugged came in as well. So thank you so much for your kind votes and your nominations. I do appreciate it. I think we came up there. If we were in the People's Choice Awards, obviously, we did some good there. So thank you so much for that, too. All right, let's get to the matter at hand. This week was Bernanke. It was all about Bernanke primarily. We saw some issues with Copenhagen, Greece. Let's talk about that. Well, Bernanke was on the grilling pad this week, and the question is whether he's going to be reappointed. Of course, also we saw the Fed statement that really saw no material change in their extended period of time that they're going to be allowing for very loose monetary policy. But at the same time, they did hint that they were going to start withdrawing some of the exceptional methods that they've used to reliquidate the banks. And if you think about that for a second, we're talking about, what, 6 months it took to reliquify the banks after they pretty much went broke? I mean, that's pretty amazing. Now, at the same time, we want to talk about what is going on with the banks because, you know, we saw what, I don't know, a chunk of the brokerages over the last few months pay back TARP. We saw beyond that, the Bank of America came and did a secondary at about five and change. That was not the right number. what was the number on Bank of America? I guess it was about five and change, 525, I think the offering was. And the stock immediately went to about 6.5 or so. A couple days later, everybody was thinking, wow, this is great. They could raise this kind of money. I mean, they raised $18 billion. That's like an IPO for a small company or actually a large company. The dilution of shares is extraordinary, but people are still gobbling this up. Took a couple more days and they realized, you know, what are we doing here? And they dropped the stock all the way back down. Citi came out and said, you know, we're going to raise money too. I mean, wow, everybody else is doing it. And of course, we want to pay off TARP because we think it's a good idea to pay back the government the money that we owe them. Plus, of course, the interest. Or do we really believe that? Or do they really want to get out from under the pay restrictions that Mr. Feinberg is levying on everybody? We'll talk about that. We've talked about that. And we'll continue to talk about that because these bankers are showing off their real true colors very dramatically. Still not loaning any money, still taking on big bonuses as much as they can and trying to get out of TARP no matter what dilution they do to the shareholders. So Citi comes out with their version of the offering where they're going to pay off TARP. And what happens? Well, the government says, wait a minute, you're offering the shares below what we paid for it? This is money that we backed you with, that we loaned you or at least to help you out. And you're coming to the table and you're deliberately diluting shares and dropping the price essentially below the price that we bought it at. And if we want to get rid of the shares, because if you do want to get out of TARP, we have to sell the shares. We have to get out of the company. We're not doing it. We're going to wait 90 days now. We're going to see what happens here. We're going to see how things play out. Now, you got to think of this in a couple different ways. The government's just going to play a little game of chicken and see what happens, and hopefully it raises up over the next 90 days so they can make some money because they don't want to get out of this deal and lose money. And then they're going to have to do a lot of splaining, as they say, right? They're going to have to do a lot of splaining to the peoples who are paying the taxes when they say that they're making money on all these deals, which we know they're not. They're going to lose their shirts on AIG. They're going to lose their shirts on the car companies, the auto companies. And at the same time, we also realize we're losing a lot of money when it comes to the TARP program. But the fact that the Fed backdoored the money into the banks makes it look a little bit better. We'll talk about that with our guest today. So Citigroup then comes out with this offering. The shares start dropping down. A couple of points, 8% the next day, 2% the next day. And then they stabilize. So they're in the threes again, right? The threes. They didn't really drop down much below or below the offering price. That would be a terrible thing. But where are we now? Are these companies that we should be looking at? I still think, even though there is a trading profit to be made on some of these, we don't know what's internally going on with these companies. Obviously, the government doesn't even know what's going on with these companies. The fact that they're out of TARP, does that make it any better? Well, look at the shares of these companies as soon as they came out of TARP. They've all pretty much dropped down. I mean, whether you look at Goldman or JP, which was just downgraded by Meredith Whitney this week, whether you look at WFC, Wells Fargo, I mean, they're all in big, well, they haven't paid back yet, actually, but they're all having a lot of difficulty. So the banking sector, to me, is still a big problem. And what I also see as a major issue here is that oftentimes, I've been spending time talking to my friend John Markman this week, you know, oftentimes you have to realize that the banking sector, the finance sector, really leads the market. And if the banking sector is telling us that the market is being led, which direction? Well, it's being directed down right now. What does that say for the rest of the market? We saw that the, five or six times recently, the mark of a 10, 11, 10, 12, and clearly 10, 20 has been closely guarded by the bears. And for whatever reason, not allowing the S&P 500 to get above that. And the 1100 mark that we were vacillating up and down on Friday, because of course that was options expiration, a major day that we saw the bulls and the bears really bang horns throughout the entire day, pushing it all around. And then what? Where are we going from here? Well, let's tell you that aside from trying to do a couple of market calls here, because there's a lot of evidence that we could talk about markets moving in either direction, the continued liquidification of the markets by the Fed is great. But at the same time, when we look at the repayment of TARP, which was originally meant to be what? It was meant to be a buying of the toxic assets, which really haven't been bought yet, but really was just a way to stuff the pockets of the banks by, at that time, Treasury Secretary Paulson, who on a knee begged Nancy Pelosi not to get this thing blown up, you know, make sure this thing goes through. We have the overhang of healthcare, which looks like it's fading almost every single day in its form and is nowhere even near what it is now compared to what it is or was in the day when it began. The president's plan has been just butchered, put back together in a way that it pleases everybody to a point that we don't know either direction it's going right now. Is it going to have a public option? Is it going to have a single payer option? Is it going to, you know, include abortions? I mean, there's so many questions right now about that. And I don't think we can make heads or tails of it. You could almost watch the insurance companies like the HMOs, like United Healthcare and maybe Aetna, WellPoint, to see what is happening on a daily basis with that, what things are being left out, what things are being included, because almost every single day it changes. Now, on top of that, we have the hangover from Dubai, or maybe everybody forgot about that already, that Dubai World was had about a $5 billion default risk going to happen, and then Abu Dhabi stepped in behind them, causing a bit of a currency panic, which really ignited the whole dollar bull run. Gold came down a tremendous amount, about 7% or so, since its high recently, because the dollar started running dramatically. The dollar started running and the carry trade started closing down, that we have talked about many times, that this carry trade is going to be a big problem when it starts closing down, and the markets kind of sold off a bit into that, and many stocks, particularly the small caps, started to kind of weaken there. And the interest-sensitive stocks had the added problem that they believe now that maybe the foot on the pedal, the accelerator, which is pushed down to the max right now, maybe slowed down a little bit by the Fed and our government. Even though we just saw another $155 billion stimulus package get pushed through, another $680 billion defense bill get pushed through, where are we going to go from here? You know, the most interesting thing is that we now have a bill to help employment. At least it's not fully signed off on, but it's going through the process. And that it's going to be dealing with shovel-ready jobs and infrastructure development. And hold the phone for a second. Didn't we do this already? Where's the money for that? How do we know the money's going to actually get out in this circumstance compared to last one, which is tied up? And they supposedly have it tied up for a period of time because it's supposed to be mid to late 2010 when this all starts working. Well, excuse me, but why would we wait such a long time to release the money? And how many jobs can we really identify that was, you know, grown by this or at least saved? I don't think you can. We know 1 million jobs are going to be placed on the rolls very soon. But at the same time, the initial claims last week at 480 was very scary. Even though we came in with $11,000 worth of 11,000 losses only the period before for the non-farm payrolls, and everybody thought things are getting better, we've ticked up from 450 to 470 to 480 on initial claims on Thursdays. We're going the wrong direction. The various manufacturing surveys that came out, except for the Philly, but the other two that came out looked horrible. Housing starts were up a little bit last week, but still not looking great. I mean, it's off a very, very low, low, low bottom. So where do we go from here? Well, we have to add the overhang now of Greece and possibly Latvia, but Greece in particular. Greece got downgraded their sovereign debt. The sovereign debt of the country got downgraded last week. And they got downgraded to BBB+, essentially, just at junk levels. But for sovereign debt, that's bad. At the same time, we have this real big problem because if they get a third downgrade, I believe it's by Fitch, if they get a third downgrade, it has to be unanimous, three downgrades at this level, they will lose their ability to collateralize their debt across the euro and that zone, and in other words, have the support of the EU, or the ECU, I guess it is. That problem is very big because it allows for one of the companies, either one of them, depending on who really put the ratings on first, to have veto power. Because if one of them just leaves it at, let's say, an A-, well, they have the ability to do whatever they need to do. At the same time, it gives the power of that company to really put the big kibosh on the country of Greece. Now, if we see a true sovereign debt problem like we may see, you know, Greece right now has their bonds and their ability to loan has been really significantly stifled, really cut down. yeah, it's still a country that's backed by all the taxing power and all that. But between them and possibly even Spain and maybe even England, boy, do we have a big concern here. Now, maybe we'll look the other way and say, oh, it's that one. It's only that one in Latvia. But the banks in England are getting trashed. You look at Royal Bank of Scotland. You look at Lloyd's. Oh, man, that stock looks horrible. Looks as bad as Bank of America and Citi right now. And a lot of that has to do with there's a lot of concern about the sovereign debt issue, which is pushing up the dollar. Most people thought the dollar trade was just a done deal. You know, the dollar was going down forever. Listen, we hear the people out there talking about that. Well, what we did was we bought EUO, which is the inverse, double inverse of the dollar against the euro. So we're profiting very nicely and hedging the portfolio very nicely with that position, up 2 times. I mean, the dollar is probably up 4% recently. So we're up 8 or 9% on that transaction right there, hedging out some of the losses that we took on gold on the recent pullback and giving us a nice little profit on some of the other positions comparatively. That's great. That's the kind of thing you want to look at. The other thing I want to talk about real quickly is some things you're going to find on the website. I want you to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Make sure you sign up for the RSS feed. You can sign up for the daily emails there. Because we talked about two things. We've been talking about Wynn and where we may see some real problems here. We are short Wynn. I'm talking about two short positions now. Short Wynn because we find that everything that's gone on and the competition that's gone on, they are only really getting benefit from their Macaw property. And their Vegas properties are having a very, very difficult time. In addition to that, what we also saw and what we also believe, this is a new, I don't know, two weeks old, this short, and we're profiting very nicely on it, is that there's going to be a lot of competition from the individual states. The individual states need to bring up their taxing revenue. It's awful. Their budgets that are already reset are drained. They need to find new ways to bring up income because they really cut down to the bone and they're not getting any excess taxes from the people or from the property taxes, as we know. What are they going to do? Well, they may start some soft gambling. They may, you know, ramp up the lottery. They may look at things like slot machines or parimutuels. And we think that's going to cause a big problem for Wynn on top of the problems they already have. Now, that's just one in that area. We also think that there's an opportunity in some of the slot machine manufacturers, which we're going to look into a little bit further before we make a recommendation. In addition to that, we've been short potash. Potash has been running up dramatically from about 85 to about 123 recently. And what we found was that there is no way really for this company to increase their pricing power because the negotiations that are going on around the world and the various potash suppliers for fertilizer are really cutting back. As a matter of fact, we saw that it was cut back this week and being undercut. In other words, companies were undercutting the spot prices as they were negotiating deals with China, India. So they dropped the price down to $400 per metric ton, and that is below market at this point. How is potash going to deal with that? Well, potash isn't dealing well with that. As a matter of fact, there was a note out just this week that talked about potash being a sell and a price target, about 82, I believe it was. And we had been short that already, and we actually added to our short right before, and potash is down dramatically in the last few days. This is a company that is a favorite of many investors, so you got to be careful kind of when the wind is blown out of the sails of the short side and the downstroke. Well, they kind of turn it up and try to get a quick profit on it, so you got to be careful. There's not a long-term forever hold, but I want you to look into that, and I want you to look at the story that we wrote that I'll link in the show notes to this particular show about potash and why we think that they've reached their height and for this point, and they're going to have some real trouble ahead. So we'll put a link in that, and maybe that's something that you could look into. When we get back, we're just going to talk with our good friend, the author of The Creature from the Jekyll Island. I always think The Creature from the Black Lagoon, but The Creature from Jekyll Island, and we'll make sure to hopefully grill him on some cool questions because, boy, the timing couldn't be any better to have him on. Great guy. We'll be right back. Oh, by the way, follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, very simply. Listen, if you do Twitter, go right there right now. I love to bring that up. I always get made fun of by John Dvorak that I only have like 4,000 or 5,000 people following, and he's like 60,000 people following him. So do me a favor, go there and retweet and tell your friends to follow us. You'll get all the instant analysis that we write on the blog automatically appears there, as well as the announcements of the podcast when they're available, etc. So we'll be right back with Ed Griffin. Stick around. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, and I promised you a very special interview today, and we are here with Ed Griffin. Now, he wrote a book. He was on before, and he wrote a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and we went through this before. It's a fascinating, fascinating account dating back in history about all the creation of the Fed. And I want to welcome him back and say hello. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me back.
Thanks. Hey, you know, this summer, I was going to send you a picture, because this summer I was driving down the coastal highways and through Jekyll Island. There was a gigantic sign that said Jekyll Island that way. And I was going to take a picture of it and send it to you, but I just couldn't stop the car. But nonetheless, let's talk a little bit, because there's been a lot of controversy, and I bet you've become a very popular fellow lately.
Well, there's been a lot of interest in my book, and it's because of the Federal Reserve and the meltdown in the economy. A lot of people who seem not to be too interested in money matters a few years ago are now very concerned, and rightly so.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a couple things that I want to go through with you. There's a lot of things I want to go through with you, but let's take it, people who haven't really heard before what your discussion is about your book, and just very briefly, let's talk about what is meant by the creature from Jekyll Island.
Well, it's kind of a half-trick title and a half-valid title. You know, if you're a writer, you've got to always think in terms of naming your books in an interesting way so that people will notice them out of all of the others on the shelf. So I was looking for a title that would capture somebody's imagination, and so The Creature from Jekyll Island rather fills that bill. But more than that, it has meaning, because the creature, of course, I'm talking about the Federal Reserve System, and if your listeners haven't already guessed it by now, I'm not a big fan of the Federal Reserve, and so I think the creature, from my perspective at least, is an appropriate word. But the Jekyll Island thing is confusing. It sounds like, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Black
People
Lagoon.
Don't realize,
yeah.
Yeah, or the Black Lagoon. Yeah. They don't realize that Jekyll Island is a real island off the coast of Georgia. And it was on that island back in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was created. Here there is a private island in those days owned by a small group of billionaires from New York City. You know, people like J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates. It was a place where their families went to spend the cold winter months, and they have a beautiful clubhouse there. It was a social club, and in fact, they called it the Jekyll Island Club, and this is where the most powerful bankers in the United States went in 1910 to secretly draft what eventually became the Federal Reserve Act. So they went there not to be observed. They went to great lengths to make sure nobody knew that they were going. They adopted code names in talking to each other. They avoided newspaper reporters. Afterwards, they denied that they went, all these things. Mainly because, you see, the Federal Reserve Act was offered to the American people, and still is being offered to the American people, as a solution to a problem, as a means by which the people and their elected representatives supposedly are able to control the banks in the best interests of the American people. Well, had anyone known in those days that this bill, supposedly to control the banks, was written by the most powerful bankers in the United States, why, then the whole scam would have been exposed. So they had to do it in secret, and they did. And boy, when I came across all this information early on in my research, I knew that I really had a tiger by the tail, because none of that information was made available to me in school. I read about the Federal Reserve, and it just sounded to me like it was a government agency, and it was all nice and well regulated, and it was, you know, in the best interests of the nation. I had no idea that this was a private group. It was, in fact, I found out that it was a cartel. The Federal Reserve System is not a government agency; it's a cartel. It's just no different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel or a sugar cartel. It happens to be a banking cartel, composed of the most powerful banks in the U.S., and they regulate their own industry. And then they went to Congress and got a bunch of compliant politicians to take their cartel agreement and pass it into law. They call it the Federal Reserve Act. It's really a cartel agreement now in law, so that it was a brilliant stroke of genius. Now they can enforce their cartel agreement and get the government to enforce it. So if you and I or banks or other institutions violate any of the terms of this private cartel agreement, we go to prison, which is why it looks like this thing is a government agency, is because it has the power of government behind it, but in reality, it's nothing more or less than a cartel.
So in terms of how this particular cartel or agency works, one of the things that has been baffling for many people for a long time is this basic and fundamental question is, where do they get their money from?
Well, they create the money absolutely out of thin air.
Okay.
Well, that's not quite. That's kind of an easy way of describing it. They create it out of debt. In other words, they loan it into existence. There's a technical term for that. In the textbooks, they call it monetizing the debt, converting debt into money. So what happens is that the banks issue a loan. They don't have any money to lend you, mind you. They just don't have it, but they issue money to you and to me in the form of a loan, and that goes on their books as both an asset and a liability. Mm-hmm. It's an asset because they're going to collect it back, and it's a liability because the borrower could lose it, in which case then they have to write it off their books. So they balance their books nicely, both an asset and a liability, and this money just springs into being, didn't exist before, and now they're collecting interest on it, which means that the banks are collecting interest on nothing. It's not a bad deal, you know?
Well,
I can see why they're in it.
Yeah, one of the things that, again, is baffling is how it took years and a tremendous amount of building and lending to get the banks into the trouble that they got into, which virtually collapsed within about a six-month period. But at the same time, they recapitalized themselves, again, according to the newest laws and rules and FASB rulings when it comes to the mark-to-market, when it comes to utilizing, as you mentioned, debt monetization from the Fed, backdoor stuffing of assets, and hiding some of the toxic waste. But essentially, it took 6 months, I think, to totally recapitalize these banks, which is quite amazing.
Well, yeah, well, don't forget that the Federal Reserve did it, and the Federal Reserve is the banks. So you see, it gets very simple to understand if you realize that the Federal Reserve is a cartel. It's not a government agency. See, basically the trick was this. The banks lost the money because they loaned money to people who cannot pay, right?
Uh-huh.
So that asset that I mentioned a moment ago that normally would be sitting on the bank's ledger earning interest all of a sudden disappears because the person says, hey, I can't pay this back. I'm walking away from my loan. And so that asset disappears, and then that means the balance sheet of the bank goes upside down, and they technically become bankrupt. So they need that money. They're going out of business if they don't get some money from some source.
Mm.
And so they can't just lend it to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the net effect is that they do that, but indirectly they lend it to the government, and then the government gives it to them.
Yeah, it's a big round
it's
robin.
It's a roundy round.
Yeah, it's a roundy
round.
Exactly.
They actually just created for themselves. They created for the government and then charge, you know, they charge interest on it. And then the government gives it to them as a bailout of some kind. And so it's a nice, tidy little deal if you're in the club, if you know how the game works. But that's only a very small number of people. Those are the top bankers, the top politicians, the people at the top of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
You know, less than 1/1000th of 1% really knows how the game works. The rest of the people are the gum-chewing public, the poor old guy that has to pay the taxes and suffers under inflation to make all of this work. And he's wondering, what the heck hit me? How come my standard mm-hmm. of living is going down?
Yeah.
Who's doing this to me?
Right. Sheep. They're sheep.
Sheep.
We're all sheep.
Yeah.
Let me play a couple of clips for you, and let me set them up, and then we'll come back. But the first one was that last week there was, and I can't forget to talk about the Time Man of the Year. We're going to get to that in a second. But last week, Senator Bunning, when looking at the reappointment and renomination, if you will, of Federal Reserve Board Chief Bernanke, really threw him under the bus and said some pretty significant things. And let's just listen to this clip. When it comes to the Greenspan put, hold on a second. Let's listen to this and we'll come right back.
Chairman Greenspan sold the Fed's independence to Wall Street through the so-called Greenspan put. Whatever Wall Street needed a boost, Allen was there. But you went even farther than that when you bowed to political pressure of the Bush and Obama administrations and turned the Fed into an arm of the Treasury. Under your watch, the Bernanke put became a bailout for all large financial institutions, including many foreign banks.
All right, so they're talking about the Greenspan put and the Bernanke put. What does that mean?
Well, I'm not quite sure.
Basically, what they're saying is...
Bunning is talking about this?
And he's saying that, you know, as he just said, so that essentially, no matter what happens with the market, we're just going to flush it with money. And the same thing with Bernanke, basically saying that the banks are not having to worry about anything because the banks are, at this point, too big to fail, and we'll make sure that they the Fed stands ready to do anything they have to make sure things work. So
Of course they can do it because it costs them nothing to do it.
Right.
They can create this money at will. Unlimited quantities can be created out of nothing virtually, and just pushed into the government's coffers first, and then the government acting under the direction of those fine, wise, trustworthy politicians, then determine who gets the money.
Right.
And of course, the first ones in line, of course, are the banks, the very people who created the money.
Mm-hmm.
They get their own money back. And then the large corporations who are deeply in debt to the banks and who are having trouble making their payments, their interest payments, they get the next huge infusion of money so that can indirectly go to the banks. And you get the idea. This is, you know, a nation of the banks, by the banks, and for the banks.
Let's listen to this next clip. This is talking about just listen to this, and we'll get right back. Because I do have your I want to ask you something about this. It talks
you
about
are
Japan.
Repeating the same mistakes of Japan in the 1990s on a much larger scale while sowing the seeds for the next bubble.
Okay, so Bunny says that this is great. He says that, you know, you're making the same mistake, Mr. Bernanke, over and over, right? And he says that basically you're making the same mistake that Japan made all those years ago and creating the next bubble. Have you been following this discussion?
Well, yes, I have been, and Bunning is absolutely correct. But he doesn't understand, or at least he's pretending not to understand, that this is the only option that the Federal Reserve System has. It's not as though it's a decision, a bad decision, that they're making the wrong decisions. He doesn't understand that that's the only decision they can make.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that the banks can do is to create more money. You see, the banks make money when they loan money. If they can't loan money, they're not making any money.
Right,
because they get it from interest.
Right, they make it from somewhere else.
Then they have to find somebody else
yeah.
to borrow the money. So any proposal which shrinks the money supply or raises the interest rates and makes it more difficult for the banks to lend money is something that the banks are going to resist with all their might
mm-hmm.
because that cuts into their income stream. And since the banks do operate and control the Federal Reserve System, that is what the Fed almost always does. It's always trying to make easy credit, easy money, low interest rates, greater supply of money, and more profit for the banks.
Right. All right, let's listen to this next clip. I think this was also interesting.
The AIG bailout alone is reason enough to send you back to Princeton. First, you told us AIG and its creditors had to be bailed out because they pose a systemic risk, largely because of the credit default swap portfolio. Those credit default swaps, by the way, are over-the-counter derivatives that the Fed did not want regulated. Well, according to the TARP Inspector General, it turns out the Fed was not concerned about the financial conditions of the credit default swap partners when you decided to pay them off at par. Not at a discount, but at 100%. In fact, the Inspector General makes it clear that no serious efforts were made to get the partners to take haircuts, and one bank offered to take a haircut, and you declined it. I can only think of two possible reasons you would not make then New York President Fed Geithner try to save the taxpayers some money by serious negotiating or at least taking up UBS on their offer of a haircut. Sadly, those two reasons are incompetence, or a desire to secretly funnel more money to a select few firms. notably Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, and a handful of large European banks.
So they're talking about the, again, Bunny's talking about the AIG bailout. Now he says that this, I mean, secretly funding, this is the stuff we've been talking about months ago, that there was this indirect route of money that went, and this is back to what we talked about a moment ago, where's the money come from? Indirect route from the Fed, from the government, to the through AIG that really secretly funded Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, and many of the foreign banks. Is that, I mean, is this finally coming to light, finally, after all the bloggers and everybody's been talking about it for so long, or is it just going to be buried?
Well, I think they're going to do everything they can to bury the that hidden transfer of money. That's why they're resisting the bill to audit the Fed. I think even if that bill is passed, they'll still do everything they can to hide the reality. So they'll say, well, this information is not available for public eyes. This is too sensitive. The public is not allowed to see this information.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they'll use some excuse like for national security. You know, that's what they always come up with.
Right.
And so I think they'll do everything they can to either stop an audit, or if they cannot stop it, they'll subvert it. And it'll be a whitewash. You know, they did that pretty well with the JFK assassination. They were going to have this big government investigation, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Warren Commission report.
Right.
Oh, thousands of pages of data, testimony, indexes, you know, all of these things. And the real truth of the matter regarding the JFK assassination was completely eliminated. It was whitewashed. The whole purpose of the Warren Commission report, in my opinion, was to conceal the ugly fact behind the assassination.
Let's not get
Same
into the open a can of worms here, my friend.
Yeah, well, I know. And I think the same thing we saw with the 9/11 Commission report, another huge, thick investigative report, thousands of pages, testimony, data, references, indexes, but the most critical testimony they didn't even print. They said, well, this was sensitive information, and it's not for public consumption. So it's another whitewash. Why wouldn't they do the same thing for the Federal Reserve System?
Well, the Federal Reserve System, all I can tell you is it's a much clearer and a much direct route. We can see it, and it's in my opinion, with the amount of money that they put on their balance sheet in terms of the loans and the money they created and the trillions of dollars right now, as well as the fact of the clear misrepresentation and misdirection. I think that's the best. They're like illusionists. It is very clear that there's something awry with the Fed. It's just amazing to me, though, that more people in the government, even though they may have, I mean, there's only really, we're going to get to a Ron Paul clip in a second, but, you know, it's amazing that there's so little people that talk about this. But I thought the most interesting part of Bunning's commentary, and it made me think of you, of course, was this. Have a listen.
We must put an end to your and the Fed's failure, and there is no better time than now. Your Fed has become the creature from Jekyll Island.
So how do you feel when Bunning said, you, sir, are, and your and the Fed has become the creature from Jekyll Island? Did you see that?
Yes, I saw that.
Did you love it? You must have loved it.
Yeah, I loved it. If I'd had a hat on, I would have thrown it in the air and go, wee-oo! Yeah,
great.
I figured somebody sent him a book to read, and I don't know if he read it, but he remembered the title.
Yeah, that was great. So Glenn Beck, I'm not a fan of Glenn Beck. That's a different discussion, though. And he had Ron Paul on, and Ron Paul was obviously has the bill, the, quote, audit the Fed bill, which he's the almost the only one that really has been pushing this. Now, the supporters of it, of course, but the only one that has been pushing it, his name has been associated with that. And he talked about the Treasury and the Fed, and he listen to this piece that he had on regarding you know, the AIG and the things that go on there.
Congressman, I want to ask you one question. I haven't heard anybody explain this. AIG, the insurance giant, the Treasury gave money, right, to AIG.
Right.
We bailed them
right
out. We think that the somehow or another the Fed is funding. So it gave it to AIG. And then what happened was AIG was getting pressure, you got to pay some of this money back. So what they did is they took two companies and sold them to pay this money back that they got back from the Treasury. But so they took that money from the sale and they gave it back to the Treasury. But what they sold these two companies to is the Fed. This circle here of money just being flushed in a giant circle seems like a, I don't know, something you would go to prison for if you tried this in the private sector. What's going on here, Congressman?
Well, shenanigans, and that really makes the point of why we need to audit and find out what the Fed does. Also, some of the banks are paying it back. They don't want any restrictions on salaries and other things. So all of a sudden, they're very rich, and they're putting money back. But what they're probably doing is borrowing money through the discount window at less than 1%. And, you know, it's a carry trade. They put their money in a treasury bill or something else, making a percent or two more. And all of a sudden, the banks have regained all those losses. But like you say, they churn this, and it's literally money coming from the Fed, which is indirectly coming from the taxpayer.
When we come back more with Ron Paul, I'm going to explain this chart.
That the shenanigans being played on the money payback to the treasury. You talked about it earlier, the circular transaction that goes on all the time, right?
Well, yes, all the time. That's the nature of the creature.
Right. Kind of the creature always is chasing its own tail. Its tail is the treasury. Well, which is the tail and which is the head? Is the head the treasury and the tail is the Fed, or vice versa?
Well, the monster itself is the Federal Reserve, and the treasury is merely the little appendage. You know, the treasury technically prints the money, you know, handles the coinage and so forth. The government still owns those facilities, the printing presses and the stamps and so forth. But the Treasury doesn't act on its own volition. It does this on the orders of the Federal Reserve System.
Right.
It's an incredible relationship. I mean, these bankers, through this cartel, literally captured control of the American money system. And they did it quietly, all in the name of, you know, protecting the people.
Yeah, because the people can't do it themselves, and they'll hurt themselves.
Yes, that's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So what do you think about this week? We saw that the Time Magazine Man of the Year, I don't know if you saw this coming, but was voted to be on the front cover, Ben Bernanke. I'm assuming that you have some differences of opinion on that nomination.
Well,
I
think I would nominate Bernanke as the Man of the Year, except I'd put a word in front of it, the worst Man of the Year.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it depends on whether that is good or bad. I mean, I suppose all of the criminals of history, at some point you could have nominated them to be Man of the Year, considering that they had great expertise in their crime. Bernanke is nothing but
a puppet,
an employee.
He?
We must understand he does not set policy.
Mm-hmm.
Bernanke works for the banks. He does what his employers tell him to do. And if they replace him, if they don't, you know, renominate him, or if he's rejected in the Senate or whatever, they're just going to put somebody in his place who is exactly like him.
Mm-hmm.
So Bernanke is kind of a lightning rod. It gets people's attention diffused away from the Federal Reserve System itself. They'd rather have people look at personalities and individuals rather than the system.
Right.
And that's where they're making a big mistake.
So you, in your book, you write about Bretton Woods, and you talk about the attack on gold and the gold standard. There's been a lot of talk. We've seen a lot of people talk about going, as a matter of fact, Ron Paul talks about gold, or at least material and commodities backing the dollar or our currency, because the dollar has been under a lot of pressure. We see Peter Schiff and a variety of other people really coming back to the notion that we need to have some kind of backing. What's your research about this? You know, after the disbanding of the gold standard, if you will, and then the changing of that, there was a couple of different times this happened. But there was an early time and a late time, right? Early in the Bretton Woods times, and then back in the Nixon times.
Yeah, it's been a transitional thing going on for quite a few years, and finally, when Nixon decoupled gold from the dollar, I think it was 1971. Why, then that was the final step. Then there was no more. When you're totally cut loose and your fractional reserve is zero, well, there's no further to go. So, yeah. But you asked my opinion. And it's not necessarily my opinion, but my observation of studying this historically. Every time a nation has abandoned gold or silver behind its money, that nation has destroyed its own economy. It has gone down the toilet in terms of economics.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that when you decouple the monetary unit from something of tangible value, like gold or silver, but then the politicians and bankers can make as much of it as they wish, and they always do. And they start to expand the money supply at a tremendously rapid rate, and that devalues the purchasing power of each of the units until finally inflation just eats away at the heart of the nation. It destroys everyone's savings. It redistributes the wealth from the middle class up to the politically favored class. It leads to dissent. revolution, violence, destruction, and usually a total tyranny takes over.
Well, that's depressing, obviously.
But
and
that's history. This is not my opinion. No, this is history.
I agree. And the truth is, if we look at very simple, this in a different context, whereas we look at the dollar linked to gold or some other commodity or tangible asset, and let's assume that that's that. And then we have non-linked, which is like monopoly money in a sense, because if you are at the top of the chain and you don't have to have a system of checks and balances that will put a one-to-one ratio or one-to-five ratio, whatever it is, of the currency that you have in the float of the economy to a backing, there is no limitation. There's no limitation.
Yes, I think the use of the term monopoly money is a good one, because if you can just imagine that the whole nation was involved in a game of monopoly, and there's a fixed amount of money in circulation, relatively fixed because it's backed by gold or silver. The amount can only be increased if somebody digs more gold or silver out of the ground, which they're constantly doing, but it's keeping pace with the expanding population. But now imagine that somebody, let's say, anybody in the game, develops a little printing press off there underneath the table, and he can start printing $50 bills and $100 bills and $1,000 bills in a monopoly money. So he now has an advantage over everyone else because he can create his own money. Now, eventually, he will buy up everything. He will rule the whole board. He will have Boardwalk, all the railroads, and everybody else will be broke. And he'll have it all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what happens in the real economy.
Right.
Those who can create money out of nothing end up having it all.
Right. Well, I'd like to read something in closing from your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, by G. Edward Griffin. Now, I know how books writing goes. You write a book, and by the time you're finished, it's a while past the initial draft. Would you agree with that?
You say it's past the initial draft. Quite a while.
Yeah. Quite a while, exactly. So if we have a date on your book that's stamped first edition here, or the edition of this is July 2009, I would venture to say that you wrote it probably, most of this, or at least the characteristics of it, a year before, let's say. I'm being kind. I know it's probably a lot longer than that, the whole process. But
well, yes, it's probably printed and actually written and in a binder about a year ahead of time.
Yeah. So what's interesting here is on chapter 24, which you titled Doomsday Mechanisms, I want to read something that obviously was written well before today, about a year, year and a half ago, at least the printed version of this ready to go to print, but probably was the genesis of it was much earlier by our friend here. And it says that
the first edition was actually 1994, and that chapter was written in 1993.
Okay, so there we go. So that even takes us back and puts us even in a better perspective for this particular chapter. And says, the decline of American prosperity, the increase in the size of government, the decrease in freedom, the growth of taxes, evidence that this is according to plan by an elite ruling group which hopes to merge the United States into world government on the basis of equality with less developed nations. The environmentalist movement shown to be an outgrowth of that plan. That is spooky. I'm sorry, my friend. That is way up on the spooky scale.
Well, you mean because it was 1993?
Yeah. If it was any time prior to, let's just give a number, 2005? I mean, come on. Talking about the major environmentalist movement with this equality. Don't forget what's happening right now. We're seeing the BRIC nations. We're seeing Brazil. We're seeing India. We're seeing Russia. We're seeing China. Not putting them down, not saying anything. But they're all talking about, this is what we're talking about, the less developed nations for the most part, although they're coming along. They're talking about getting rid of the dollar and going to a different currency, either a world-based currency or a commodity-based currency. So this prediction, this commentary that you had is pretty accurate, I must say.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry that it is, but you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a clairvoyant to predict the future if you know who is creating the future.
Right.
Now, I don't know about your listeners whether the concept of an elite is a shocking concept to them or whether they reject it or accept it, but it's a real thing, and if you read the writings of these elitists, the master planners out there, and I've been reading their stuff for decades, it's easy to see what's going to happen because they're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're they're discussing the strategy and the steps by which they can implement that strategy. So you don't have to be really a clairvoyant. Just read their stuff.
And never before has it been so clear as it is under this administration, in my opinion.
Yes.
Let me rephrase that. It may have been the same all along, but somehow this administration feels compelled to tell us about it.
Yes. Well, that's true. The closer you get to the goal, the closer you get to the waterfall, the louder the sound.
Yep, and the wetter you get.
Yeah.
And the more chance you have of drowning.
That's correct.
Yep. Well, listen, everybody, this is Edward Griffin, again, gracing us with a secondary, a follow-up, an encore for his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And, of course, we're going to put this is a jam-packed book with all sorts of great information on here. Hey, Willie Nelson gave you a thing on the back here, huh?
Yep. Nice. Well, may I mention where people can get this
book?
Yeah,
no, absolutely. We're going to put it on our – let me just tell you. Okay. We're also going to put it on our website so that people can link over. But tell us the best place to get the book.
Well, the best place is right from our own store. We call it the Reality Zone. Easy name to remember, realityzone.com. So you'll find The Creature there plus 100 other books and video and audio recordings relating to this and similar topics.
Great. You know what we need to do? We need to put a little kind of like a desk-sized creature that represents what this is as a little, like a bobblehead. Wouldn't that be nice?
I think it would be. Yeah.
I think we got to do something like that.
Whose head are we going to put on the thing?
Well, there's only one right now, the one that's on Time Magazine at this point.
But
it somehow needs to be a merging of, we need a Volcker, Bernanke, Greenspan kind of meld. You know what I mean?
I do.
A full cycle meld would be kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what that would look like.
It would be as ugly as the Fed is today. How's that?
I like the idea.
All right, my friend. Ed Griffin, thanks for joining us. Again, it's The Creature from Jekyll Island, and get your copy. I think it's an awesome book. And that's if you don't want to sleep at night because it tells the truth of what's going on, it seems, with the Fed. But thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming out with such a great piece on this. And we'll speak to you soon.
Dave, well, thanks for inviting me.
All right,
glad
bye-bye.
To be here. Bye.
All right, well, that's about it. Thanks so much for having the time with I'm thanking Ed, actually, for the time. Thanking you for the time. And I want to wish you a wonderful holiday weekend. Coming up, we'll do our best to have some great shows in the next week, of course. And we have some things that lined up already for working on some ideas for next week and the next year and the next month. And profiting is the name of the game here. So I want to thank you again for joining me. I wish you a great time. See you soon. Make sure to subscribe to Andrew Horowitz over at Twitter, at Andrew Horowitz. And check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And finally, I want you to make sure to listen to DH Unplugged. We give stock tips each week, and I tell you on there how to find the actual spreadsheet in Google where we recommend stocks and to track it so you can see what's happening and follow along. Until then, I'll see you soon. Next week's going to be great. Have a wonderful and a prosperous week. This is Andrew Horowitz saying bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.